The next case on calendar and the last one of our Las Vegas Law and Bond Group this month is Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation versus Rhodes, case number 59309. Justice Gibbons was unavoidably absent, but he has read the briefs and will listen to the oral arguments off the website, and he plans to participate fully in the disposition of the case. So I wanted to let you know that. You'll have the full seven-judge court. Is counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please step forward.
Thank you, Your Honor. Michael Wixon, representing the FDIC. I'm prepared to answer the questions that the court posed in the September 23rd order at its election. I'd like to reserve about 3 minutes for rebuttal. At the court's discretion, I would be happy to address those questions first or address first the general reasons why we believe that the
district. Whatever works best for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll give a general overview then of why we believe the district court should be reversed. There are two primary reasons that we believe that the district court should be reversed. The first is that under applicable law, it doesn't matter if section 40.4551 is deemed to be a statute of repose or a statute of limitation. Under section 1821D14 of the United States Code, the clear language of that statute would indicate that whether it's a statute of repose or a statute of limitation, it would still apply and apply in this particular case, allowing the FDIC to be sued to be timely. The second reason is, even if you assume, which we don't, that section 40.4551 is a statute of limitation, Respondent Rhodes has already admitted that if it is a statute of limitations, then section 1821D would govern, meaning that the FDIC suit would be timely. I'll address the first reason. If you go to this plain language of section 1821D, section 1821D specifically states that it is the statute of limitation for any action by the FDIC, and that the limitation period for such action shall be the greater of 6 years or the applicable state period of limitation, whichever period is longer. Congress gave the FDIC as receiver the longer of 6 years of the applicable state time period to bring any contract period or contract in order to maximize potential recoveries for foreign assets. In fact, if you go to the specific language of the legislative history of that statute, Senator Riegel said, section 1821D14, statutes of limitation are of the utmost importance. Extending these limitation periods will significantly increase the amount of money that can be recovered by the federal government through litigation. The provision should be construed to maximize potential recoveries by preserving to the greatest extent permissible by law claims that would otherwise have been lost due to the expiration of the hitherto applicable limitation periods. And we believe that's a clear policy justification for the application of Section 1821D to this particular case, making the FDIC's suit timely. Respondent argues that the Nevada 6-month limitation period for deficiency actions set forth in 40.4551 should still apply because 1821D distinguishes between statutes of limitations and statutes of repose. But applicable law doesn't support that analysis. In fact, two recent cases which we provided in supplemental briefing to the court from the Second Circuit and the Tenth Circuit have specifically rejected that analysis. Those two courts have rejected the distinguishing that distinguishment, and they in fact specifically held that whether it's a statute of repose or a statute of limitation, section 1821D would apply. In the Manure case, which we cited, the facts almost identical to this case, the Tenth Circuit clearly and unequivocally held that a federal statute identical to section 1821D displaced all state statute limitation periods, whether they were statute of repose or statutes of limitation. Also, in UBS America's case, the Second Circuit analyzed an extender statute applicable to the Federal Housing Finance Agency. And the Second Circuit came to the same conclusion as the Manure case and held that the extender statute displaced the state limitations period, whether the state statute was a statute of repose or a statute of limitations. In reaching their holdings, both courts looked to the plain language of Section 1821D, the language that I cited just a few minutes ago, to evidence the clear intent of Congress, and came to the same conclusion, and this court should do the same. I'll note as a side note that the Fifth Circuit case, the Stonehenge case, which we cited in my brief originally, also came to the same conclusion. So we had the Fifth Circuit, the Second Circuit, and the Tenth Circuit, all of which will come to that, use that analysis, and come to the same conclusion.
However, countrywide would come to a different conclusion, is that correct?
Well, the most recent countrywide case, the Central District of California, we believe that that's an outlier case, much like the Wilson case. That case has been set for reconsideration by the judge, and that case will be appealed, we believe, to the Ninth Circuit. The second reason that this court, we believe, should reverse the district court is that Respondent Rhodes concedes that Section 1821D applies to procedural statutes of limitation. Section 40.4551 is a procedural statute of limitation, and Respondent has conceded that Section 1821D applies in that case. Now, statutes of limitation bar a cause of action after a certain time period measured from when a cause of action accrues. Section 40.4551, like any other statute of limitation, bars an action after a certain period of time measured from when the cause of action accrues, and that's by definition. With a deficiency action, the cause of action accrues when the trustee's sale is held, because it is only then when a lender may determine the amount of the deficiency, by definition, because the sales price will allow the court to later establish the amount of the definition, and so that would be the point of accrual. Now, if a limitation period is going to accrue from a specific point of time, then by definition it would be a statute of limitation. And then when statutes of repose are triggered by an action of a defendant, whether or not there's an underlying cause of action. For example, and this was the case in the Second and the Tenth Circuit with respect to securities laws claims, and with a securities laws claim, for example, a securities statute would apply from the date of purchase, whether or not the purchaser knew that there was a cause of action. That would be a statute of repose. It would extend or apply whether or not the statute had accrued. That's not the case here, and that's certainly not the case with Section 40.4551 by definition. And so, as Respondent Rhodes has indicated, if, in fact, 40.4551 is a statute of limitation, then in this case, Section 1821D would apply anyway to displace that and allow the FDIC suit to be timely. I'd like now to address the four specific questions that this court addressed to us in an effort to, I believe, more fully understand the underlying issues of the case. The first question was, is the Nevada six-month limitation period triggered after a trustee's sale for a foreclosure sale? In other words, does the lender's cause of action accrue at the time of sale? Now, as indicated a few minutes ago, logically speaking, an action accrues when a lawsuit may be filed based on the facts that give rise to the action. And in this case, the cause of action would accrue at the time of the sale, because the sale is what gives rise to the deficiency cause of action. You can't establish a deficiency without a sale. But that would mean that, by definition, it's a statute of limitation. An action brought before that six-month period of time would be premature. That's based on the notion that you're bringing a deficiency action based on the sale. It has to be brought within that six-month period of time following the sale, which, again, by definition, would make it a statute of limitation. By contrast, the statute of repose applies to a case whether or not the cause of action has accrued, and that's not the case here. The second question posed by the court is the Resolution Trust Company versus Olson case, how does that apply? The court engaged in an analysis there of a state and a federal statute, but did not use the term preemption, or did not use a preemption analysis. And the court asked, is it possible to engage in such a statutory analysis without a preemption analysis? And the brief answer to that question is yes, as clearly indicated by the Tenth and by the Second Circuit. Both of those courts focused on the clear intent of Congress, as demonstrated by the plain language of the statute. We believe that those courts engaged in essence, a preemption analysis, because that's the first step in any preemption analysis, is whether or not there's express preemption. And express preemption would be a function of whether or not the intent of Congress was clear, and we believe, of course, that it's clear here. The terminology really isn't important in that regard. What's important, and what's the key factor for the court to consider, is the intent of Congress as determined by the language of the statute. And the Tenth and the Second Circuits, when they evaluated the preemption, when they evaluated the intent intent of Congress in that particular case came to the conclusion, as I just said earlier, but it doesn't matter if it's a statute of repose or a statute of limitations, it still applies. They went through a long line of federal court cases to come to that conclusion, and when they came to that conclusion, they did so for several reasons. The first is, as they looked at the way that Congress, or the way that the term statute of limitation was viewed by Congress at the time that FIRA was enacted, those courts determined that the phrase statute of repose was in fact a subset of an overall statute of limitation. And in fact, the term statute of repose, or statute of limitations rather, is used several places in FIRA as in a context where it cannot be told. So in other words, Congress used the phrase statute of limitation in the same way that we would otherwise use the phrase statute of repose. And I was intent from the Second Circuit, not through that analysis, based even on a Supreme Court case, they came to the conclusion that for that reason, statutes of repose and statutes of limitation should be viewed as one and the same for purposes of that analysis. The third question presented by the court was, Respondent Rhodes relies in part on the RFC versus Breeding case. The Breeding Court stated that the United States was not excused from satisfying a state statutory prerequisite, quote, except to the extent that a statute of the United States is applicable. The question was, does that statement acknowledge that a federal statute may apply in place of a state statute? And we believe, of course, the answer is yes. There's a key distinguishing factor between this case and the Breeding case. In the Breeding case, there was no federal statute that established a specific statutory limitation period, as there is in this case. And so I think that the language in the Breeding case really isn't dicta. I think that the court was acknowledging the state of the law and the analysis at that point in time. The third question put forth by the court in the September 23rd order was, should the resolution of whether USC Section 1821 applies to displace 40.45512 on the intent of Congress with a procedural or substantive nature of 40.4551? And as I indicated earlier in my analysis, I don't know that it really matters because we come to the same conclusion. And that is, if it's a statute of repose, Section 18.21d applies. If it's a statute of limitations acknowledged by the respondent, Section 18.21d applies. But if you go to the clear intent of Congress as set forth in the statute itself, Section 18.21d applies, making the FDIC's action a timely action. And so in brief, the answer to the fourth question would be, in either case, it doesn't matter if Section 1821D would displace the state statute. I'd like to address one final issue. And much has been made in the respondent's brief about waiver and what was waived and what wasn't waived. If you go to pages 1-3, 1-2, 1-3, 1-4 of our appendix, that was the brief that we filed with the state court. And in the state court action, we quoted at length, in the state court briefing, we quoted at length from the Oakson case, and specifically we use the following phrase. However, under federal law, it is clear that a state's statutory time limitation, whether the statute is one of limitation or repose, cannot bar a claim made by a federal agency. So clearly we preserve that issue for appeal, and we believe that our briefs appropriately address the preemption issue, appropriately address the issue relating to the intent of Congress. We didn't need to use the word preemption because as we indicated, or as indicated by the Tenth Circuit and by the Seventh Circuit, they didn't use the word preemption either, not even the Olson case. The issue is not one of terminology, the issue is one of analysis. What was the intent of Congress? And as you look at the seminal cases in this area, the seminal cases would be now the Tenth Circuit Court and the Tenth Circuit Court, both of which chose not to go through or use the word preemption, but both of which clearly focus on the intent of Congress, which is where our focus was at the district court and where our focus has been in the appellate briefs that we filed. With that, I'll reserve the balance of the time.
Thank you. Mr. Santorum?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Nick Santorum on behalf of the respondent, James Rhodes. I want to start with what I think is the most important issue before you today, and that is the analytical construct by which to view this case. And what I would urge the court to do, as we did in our recent supplement, is to look at the countrywide decision, just to say that, of the Central District of California, in August of 2013 decision, that I think lays out the analysis very well. And if you look at the countrywide analysis, step one is it a statute of repose, this deficiency judgment statute in Nevada, or a statute of limitation? Why that is so important, excuse me, is because, as counsel says, if in fact you determine anew that the deficiency judgment statute in Nevada is a statute of limitation, then I would concede that the FIREA extender statute on its face applies to statute of limitation, and it would override Nevada's six-month rule for a deficiency judgment. That's if you find the statute of limitation. That's why this is the first step, and it's critical. If you do not find statute of limitation and instead find statute of repose, and I'm going to get into why this court should adopt the district court's reasoning that it was a statute of repose, at that point, the federal government bears the burden of raising, establishing, prevention at the trial court level. It's their burden. The burden is always on the proponent of preemption to establish preemption. And so how do we do that? Well, while this issue, the NRS 40.455, may be an issue of first impression before this court in this state, I would submit to you respectfully that the 2007 decision that now appears provides this court, provides us, with guidance for how we analytically determine whether or not something is a statute of repose or statute of limitation for purposes of preemption analysis. And how do we do that? The now Pierce decision made it very clear two things. Number one, in an area such as this, deficiency judgments, which are traditionally regulated by states, there is a strong presumption against preemption, a strong presumption against preemption that this court recognized in now Pierce. Secondly, the court in now Pierce also recognized that in order for Congress to have intended to supplant an area of traditional state regulation, that intention must be clear and manifest. So you have a strong presumption against and a standard of clear and manifest intention of Congress. How do you do that? Now Pierce lays out the analysis. Is there express preemption? Is there implied preemption? And then you have other subcategories, field, conflict, impossibility, and obstacle. Okay? It's a very complex analysis, but it's one that I would suggest has not been done in this case, and you cannot find it anywhere in the record. In this case, the FDIC stopped at step one. Step one was statute of limitation, statute of repose. They put all of their eggs in the statute of limitation basket. I read from page 30 of our appendix, which is page 16 of the transcript from the oral argument. My colleague, Mr. Dixon, says, quote, and so as Mr. Santoro indicates, the issue before the court is, what is this? Is the Nevada one action rule a limitation period, a statute of limitation, or is it, in fact, a statute of repose? And that really is the only issue before this court today. Okay, so they defined it as, well, it's limitation, and if it's limitation, they win, I concede, we'd have to reverse and remand. If it's repose, they didn't go further under the countrywide analysis. Step two is, did Congress intend to preempt Nevada's deficiency legislation with the FIREA extender statute? They didn't do any of that. So, on this record, the district court never reached the issue of preemption for good reason. They never raised it. They never briefed it. They never analyzed it. And the proof is in the pudding. The first time you will see any mention in their papers about nanopierce or about preemption, the word itself, is in their appellate brief on appeal for the first time. It is a brand new argument. And they may say, we didn't raise it. It wasn't my burden to raise it. It's the government's burden as the proponent of preemption to raise it. They didn't raise it. So what I would suggest to this court, with all due respect, given that the FDIC put all of its eggs in one basket at the trial court, I believe the only issue that's properly before you now on appeal is whether or not the district court erred in finding that NRS 40.455 is, in fact, a statute of repose. That issue is fair game, it's properly before the court, but I do not think it's fair game for this court at this point, given the status of this record and the FDIC's failure to make the preemption argument in the lower court, to now come with a brand new argument and say there's preemption. I don't think that's appropriate on this record.
In the countrywide case, though, FDIC conceded that the Texas five-year statute was a statute of repose, correct? So they framed the argument that way. They didn't have the dispute, the initial dispute of is it fish or fowl?
In the Countrywide decision, the recent one, they went through an analysis. The court went through, the Central District Court of California went through the analysis and concluded it was a statute of repose after going through the factors as to why it should be. And I'm happy to walk through those because I really do think that's the issue before this court today. And I would suggest respectfully that if you agree with the trial court that this is in fact a statute of repose for the reasons we're going to talk about now, then I think the court should affirm because the issue of preemption is not before this court. The issue on statute of repose versus statute of limitation is this. The Nevada analysis is, and I think counsel alluded to it, I don't think it's very much in dispute, a statute of repose has set forth the limitation period for a fixed period of time from a defined event. A statute of limitation, on the other hand, is when you have occurrence or discovery of injury or damage. That's when the time begins to run. So what we have here in the deficiency judgment statute, it says 6 months, the application has been made within 6 months from the date of the foreclosure sale or trustee sale. Not from the date that the lender discovers that there's a deficiency. That would be damage in this case. When does a lender discover that he's been damaged, that there's a deficiency? Well, there's a couple of things that have to happen first. You have the foreclosure sale, courthouse steps, wherever it happens to be, typically done by a title company. The next thing that happens is a trustee's deed is recorded. Okay? And that trustee's deed has the recital of consideration. If the consideration paid for the real property that was the security is equal to or exceeds the amount of the debt, there's no deficiency. So before you can even think about a claim for deficiency judgment, you've got to get the trustee's deed. How long does that take? I realize it's not in the record, but we check with some title companies, ordinary course, about a week, because what they have to do is they collect the money at the sale, then they have to calculate and collect the transfer tax. Then they do the declaration of value form, and they have to get all that together, record that at the counter. Sometimes the county accepts it, sometimes they don't. Then you get a recorded deed back that you can give to the lender. Now this is typically, if all goes well, about a week after the foreclosure sale. But guess what? It doesn't matter when they find out. Because it's a statute of repose, the clock starts ticking on the day of the foreclosure sale. From the courthouse steps on, it doesn't matter how long it takes the title company to get you the trustee's deed. Secondly, what's the second step you have to have before you can have a deficiency judgment claim? You've got to know what the value of the property is. So at some point along the way, the lender has to get an appraisal. Now, maybe he'll do that diligently. I mean, it's possible all these things can happen very soon, okay? But not typical. The lender has to go out and get an appraisal. If the lender does not get his appraisal to discover that the fair market value of the property does not exceed the indebtedness, and if it doesn't, there is no claim. If he doesn't do that within 6 months, the claim is barred before he even knows he has a claim. That's what makes this a statute of repose. It's an absolute time period which begins to run from the date of the foreclosure sale. There's no equitable tolling. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. There's no way that date can be extended. You can't come in and say, well, I didn't discover that there was a deficiency until I got the trustee's deed. I didn't discover until I got my appraisal. None of those things matter. What matters is you have a fixed event, a defined event of foreclosure sale. 6 months from then, the claim is gone.
Unless it's multiple pieces of property.
Then you go by the last, I believe.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to talk about Nevada's deficiency legislation because some of the cases, not so much the Nevada cases, they talk about repose versus limitation. They look at the question as to whether or not the state statute created the right or whether it's merely a procedural limitation on that right, as in the Texas cases. And that's how I distinguish those. But the Nevada deficiency statutes, you start with NRS 40.430, which is the one action rule. Okay? What it says, I'm going to paraphrase, but this part's a quote, there may be but one action for the recovery of any debt, it goes on to say, which is secured by a mortgage or a lien upon real estate. So we've got the one action rule, okay? There's one action to recover upon secured real estate debt, and this is it. It creates the cause of action. It goes on further within this provision. And it then limits the right Under 40.457, 40.459, you've got the fair market value limitations and the payment limitations. And then it goes further than the statute we're talking about, 40.455, to terminate the right. The application must be made within 6 months after the date of the foreclosure sale or trustee sale. Doesn't matter whether you wait and discover that there's a deficiency. Within 6 months after that, it terminates. So you've got, unlike those other state statutes in Texas, you have got a statute with Nevada legislation that creates and defines the right, limits the right, and terminates the right. That's why it's called the one-action rule, and that's why it's a statute of repose. I want to spend a minute talking about public policy here, because I don't think it's determinative of the outcome. I think under the if the court concludes this is a statute of repose, then I don't think the issue of preemption is fairly before the court, but I'll talk about that in a second if I have any time left. One of the things that strikes me about this is what an absurd result can issue if you accept the FDIC's notion of how this all should go down. You've got, that is deficiency legislation. We attach the legislative history. The intent of the statute is clear. It's to guarantee certainty to borrowers. You can't have debtors hanging in limbo, and that's a quote from the statute. If the FDIC is able to come in and transform a six-month statute into a six-year statute, just think of what that's going to do. 12 banks failed in Nevada so far. I believe there are more on the watch list. I'm not sure we're completely out of the woods yet. But the notion that there may have been a secured real estate loan that was foreclosed 5 or 5.5 years ago, okay, and now if that bank goes out of business and the FDIC steps in, they can come in and institute an action that expired 5 or 5.5 years ago? That's the construction that they're
going to do. Don't they concede that the extender statute would only apply if the FDIC were the foreclosing party? In other words, the FDIC had to come in for the bank and itself initiate the foreclosure as in your case?
I don't read it that way, Justice Pickering. If you look at that extender statute, it doesn't say only if the FDIC was in the shoes of the failed institution at the time. Now, that happened to be the case here.
Right.
The FDIC here actually had already succeeded to Community Bank at the time of the foreclosure. So really, there was no excuse for them missing out in the 6 months. But I look at that extender statute, and it's like this. It doesn't say only if they had succeeded to divide the bank then. I think the way this thing is written, I think the way they're urging the court to apply it, is that they can actually revive a claim that may have been dead for 5 years. So we're leaving this to the vagaries of just bad luck. Which bank might fail? Well, if you did business with a strong bank that didn't fail, and there was a foreclosure 5 years ago, you're safe. But if some Las Vegas bank fails tomorrow, they could go back 6 years. I think that's poor policy. Now, what I'd like to do with the very short amount of time I have left is distinguish the, I just want to talk about, counsel relies on Maria and UBS, some of these cases that they talked about in their settlements. First of all, there were extensive preemption analyses in those cases that is not in this case. And so my position, to be clear, is it's waived. They reached a different result than Countrywide did. And what I would suggest to the court is I think the Countrywide analysis more closely comports with Nevada law. And here's why. In Nano Pierce, the court held those two things. Strong presumption against preemption in areas that are traditionally regulated by states. Deficiency. I'm not aware of any federal deficiency legislation. So it's an area regulated by states. Secondly, Congress' intent to preempt must be clear and manifest. It's not presumed. It must be clear and manifest. Countrywide's analysis recognizes both of these principles in concluding that there is insufficient evidence to determine that Congress had a clear and manifest intent to preempt, in that case, these were securities laws. Neither Monroe nor UBS even mentions those two things, the presumption against or the clear and manifest standard. Countrywide did an analysis of the legislative history of FIREA and found there was no mention of repose in the legislative history of FIREA. So under their analysis, they found that, no, there was no clear and manifest intention to supplant state law here. I believe I'm out of time. If the court had any questions,
Does anyone have any questions?
Is your opponent that Countrywide rehearing has been granted?
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with that. I'm not here to dispute that. I don't know that.
Thank you.
Does anyone else have any questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Santoro. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you. Your Honor, first country law will be re-argued in November. With respect to some of the points, just very briefly, as much respect and regard as I have for Mr. Marcos, he's just wrong. We have never argued and will not argue that somehow this revives a dead cause of action. If a cause of action expires before the FDIC takes over a bank, the cause of action is gone. That's it. Number two, with respect to the waiver argument, I think it's absolutely critical that this court understand that Respondent Rose has already acknowledged preemption. The moment Respondent Rose said that 1821D applies, if this is a statute of limitations, he has acknowledged that the clear intent of Congress was that Section 1821D applies. So the preemption, the whole preemption analysis presented by Respondent Rhodes, I believe, is a red herring, because he's already acknowledged preemption by making that admission, number one. Number two, I think he's taking one statement out of context, made an oral argument. When you go to our briefs are very clear. As I cited on pages 103 through 106 of the underlying brief that we filed, we were absolutely clear that if this is a statute of repose, that whether it's a statute of repose or a statute of limitations, it doesn't matter. We made that point very clear, and it's in the record. I'd like to talk for just a second about...
We're out of time, but you may wrap up your thought.
Okay, I was just going to say that there's a... Never mind. And wrapping up would take another 5 minutes.
Okay, well then in that case, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank all counsel for the briefs and oral arguments. They were very good. And this matter will stand submitted and will be recessed.